Well-meaning parents today often unintentionally hurt their children by focusing too much on their children's happiness or achievements, according to my guest, Richard Weisbord. He's the author of the new book, The Parents We Mean to Be. He's a child and family psychologist on the faculty of Harvard. His earlier book, The Vulnerable Child, was named by the American School Board Journal as one of the top 10 education books of all time. Weisbord is the father of three children. Richard Weisbord, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book is about how well-intentioned adults can undermine children's moral and emotional development. What do we even mean when we say moral development?
Well, I think when we're talking about moral development, we're really talking about a number of moral capacities. We're talking about moral reasoning, you know, your ability to think through moral problems. We're talking about your sense of justice and, you know, developing a sense of fairness and justice, your sense of caring, your sense of responsibility. We're talking also about social and emotional capacities, you know, the capacity to help other people without patronizing them or to give feedback constructively. These day-to-day social skills that I think are very much a part of morality. So that's mainly the kinds of things that I'm talking about. I will just also say that I think as a culture, we're very focused on moral literacy, on whether or not kids know the values, on whether kids know what's right from wrong. But one of the things you see is by the time kids are 5 or 6 years old, they basically know the values. You know, they basically know what right and wrong is. And, you know, the bigger issue is really having those values be internalized, having those values be a part of the self, a part of a child's identity. So those values become more important than their moment-to-moment happiness at a given moment, or they're able to stand up for those values, even if it has a cost to themselves. So, you know, I think our focus shouldn't be on moral literacy. I think it should be on this much deeper issue of moral identity.
Now, I hear a lot of parents say with pride that their child is like their best friend. You don't think that's really a very good thing. Why not?
Well, you know, on the whole, I think it's a very positive trend that parents want to be close to their kids. I mean, I think it's a wonderful trend that parents are sharing more with their kids, they're listening to their kids, they're spending more time with their kids. But, you know, I'm also worried about it in some respects. It's, you know, for one thing, some parents, when they treat their kids as their best friends, become dependent on their kids and emotionally dependent on their kids. And it's much harder to discipline or to make demands or to create high moral expectations when you're dependent on your kids. We also need to let our kids separate from us. I mean, that's critical for them emotionally and morally to be able to separate from us. And when we're dependent on them, when they're our best friends, that's harder to do. And, you know, just I think the final thing I will say about it is that, you know, kids need to idealize us. And that's really the way in which they internalize our values. That's the way they adopt our values. And if we're their best friend, we're treating them like we're equals. And I think it can undermine that process of idealization.
Now a lot of the parents are the children of the baby boomers. And I'm wondering if you see any, I know that we're getting into generalization here, but if you see any generational differences between baby boom parents and the children of baby boom, how they behave as parents?
You know, I think there are some differences between the baby boom generation and this generation of parents. I think there's, I mean, to some extent, this was certainly true of the baby boom generation of parents, but there is a very high focus among this generation of parents on their kids' moment-to-moment feelings, which I think is somewhat different. I mean, this is one of the things that you see on playgrounds a lot. You see parents who, you know, and I don't want to cartoon parents here because this certainly isn't true of all parents, but you see parents who are noting their kids' moods every 5 or 10 minutes, you know, saying, that must make you frustrated, or that must make you angry, or that must make you sad. And it's sort of like pulling a bandage up every 5 minutes to see if a wound is healing. And so I do think there is that kind of close monitoring of kids' feelings going on. And, you know, and in some respects, this is a good thing that parents are trying to help their kids articulate their feelings. But at the level it's going on, I think it can be irritating and stultifying and intrusive. And
why?
At this level?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it just sort of breaks down spontaneous play if parents are noting every 5 or 10 minutes how kids are feeling. And it's just very unrelaxing for kids. And You know, I think also sometimes kids have to just work out these feelings on their own terms. So, you know, I'm all for parents helping kids express their feelings and doing it when these feelings are prolonged. I'm worried about some parents and the frequency of it.
When I was growing up, if you were away from home and away from your parents, you were out of reach for that amount of time. But now between cell phones and texting, parents and children can be in constant communication. And I wonder, you know, as a parent and as an observer and expert on parent-child relations, how do you think that's changing relationships?
Well, you know, I just think it depends. I just think the amount of contact you have with your kid is really not a good barometer of closeness or healthiness. That some kids really don't want much contact with their parents, and that can be absolutely fine. They want to be independent, and that's great. And other kids want a lot of contact, and they want a certain kind of intimacy, and that can be great as well. You know, I do worry some about parents micromanaging and hovering too much, and if being in cell phone contact is a way in which they're micromanaging and hovering, you know, that's not a good thing. I was visiting a college with my son, and, you know, parents were asking questions like, you know, during an admissions process. We were just doing a tour of the college, and parents were asking questions like, is there a rotating shower schedule, and does the washing machine take cards or coins? I mean, there's a level of micromanaging that goes on that gets pretty nutty sometimes. But again, I don't think frequency of contact is really the barometer of closeness.
Another thing you're worried about is parents who try to be an authority figure and a therapist to their child at the same time. What's the conflict there?
Well, you know, I think sometimes kids really need to work out their anger toward their parents on their own terms. And you know, if being a therapist means, you know, listening to your kid and sometimes helping your kid process their feelings, that's a great thing. But if we're talking about young kids and we're, you know, kids who are 4 or 5 or 6 years old and kids are getting angry at their parents and their parents are trying in the moment to help their kids process their feelings for them, I mean, sometimes that's very appropriate. But I think as a parent, you just have to be very careful that it's not about protecting you. It's not about securing you because you're worried about is you can't bear your child being angry at you because that you're doing it because you feel like this is a very important moment for kids to process their feelings, because kids, you know, will get angry at you sometimes, and they do have to work out their anger in their way.
And you think sometimes by playing the role of therapist, you're basically trying to explain, to rationalize your own treatment of the child and get them to agree that you were right, they shouldn't be angry at you?
Yeah. No, sometimes I think that's right. You're trying to get the child to agree they shouldn't be angry at you, or that you have they have a good reason for being angry at you. And, you know, sometimes they're just angry. You know, they have to leave the park or they have to leave the pool and they're angry and they'll get over it and it doesn't really need to be discussed.
You know, you write in your book how parents are often obsessed with their children's happiness. But sometimes by elevating happiness as the most important thing, there are other really important values that get demoted in the process. Could you describe your concerns there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's a concern about happiness and about self-esteem. And I just, you know, think in a day-to-day way, there are subtle ways in which we all prioritize our kids' happiness over their caring for others or their taking responsibility for others. And, you know, on playgrounds, you see parents who are very attuned to how their kids are doing moment to moment, but they're not helping their, you know, and again, not all parents, but they're not helping their kids, you know, reach out to a friendless kid on the playground, or they're letting their kid interrupt a group of older kids during a game. They're not helping their kids tune into other kids. And, you know, with my own kids, I feel like, you know, there have been times where I haven't insisted that they return phone calls from friends, or I've let them write off kids that were annoying, or one of the stories I talk about in the book is a couple who has, you know, they have a junior in high school and she's thinking about whether or not she wants to quit the soccer team because she's not enjoying it anymore. And the mother says, you know, you should quit. It's not fun for you anymore. And the father says, but, you know, it's important for your college resume. But neither of them are thinking about the team and, you know, her obligations to the team. And so I just worry we're off whack with this, that we're out of balance, and our focus, you know, in these ways becomes very much on our individual kids' well-being and not on their sense of responsibility for others. And the irony is that, you know, I feel like if our kids are able to tune in and focus and care about other people, they're going to have better relationships their whole lives. They're going to be better parents. They're going to be better grandparents. They're going to be better friends to people. I mean, this is the foundation for lifelong happiness. So in the end, I think, you know, the focus on individual kids' happiness is not only going to make them less moral, but it's going to make them less happy in the end.
For years, you've been writing about the overemphasis on self-esteem, and in your new book, you write that Americans have become intoxicated with the power of self-esteem. What are some of the ways that educators and parents have been using to try to build self-esteem that you're concerned about?
Well, one of them is praise. And you know, praise for real accomplishment is very important. Praise for effort, real effort, is very important. But again, I think that you see an excess of praise. I mean, you see a kind of steady stream of praise sometimes and in schools, and you see it with parents and on playgrounds. You know, not long ago, I was watching a father and a son play catch with a ball, and every single time the kid threw the ball or caught the ball, the father praised it, and when the kid dropped the ball, he said, "Nice try." And there are sports programs that are advocating, you know, that you praise kids five times for every time you criticize them. And, you know, again, I think it's very important to praise kids, but you know, one of the things that happens is I think at some point kids feel like this praise is meaningless, that it's vapid. I think sometimes when they're getting praised a lot, they can also feel patronized by it. Like, why do adults need to keep propping me up? When you're praising kids all the time, you're also judging them all the time. And, you know, so I think kids feel like their performance is at stake. And there's this research that says that, you know, kids who are feeling like their performance is at stake all the time and who are praised a lot can get very competitive and very threatened by other kids. And I just think it's important that we're mindful about why when we're praising a lot, about why we're doing it, and really think about it, you know, how our kids are responding, and think about, you know, is this about real accomplishment, and is this about real effort?
So your concern in part is that we're trying to build self-esteem by praise, but that's not necessarily going to build durable self-esteem. What do you think will?
Well, I think the chain here is I think we think that praise, among other things, will build self-esteem, and then self-esteem will build character. You know, I think self-esteem primarily comes from competence, you know, from being good at things at school, you know, having social competence. And I think it also comes from virtue, from acting virtuously, if that's something that's valued in your family or community. I think it comes from having good relationships, too, you know, close relationships in which you're really appreciated. So, you know, I think if we focus on helping kids develop those things, we're going to be in much better shape. You know, rather than happiness or self-esteem being the goal, one of the things I'm arguing in the book is that I think it makes sense for maturity to be the goal. And, you know, if you think of maturity as the ability to take other people's perspectives and to manage destructive feelings and to take criticism and to learn from it and to be self-observing, you know, I think those are the qualities in the end that, you know, are the basis for morality, but I also think they're the basis for good relationships and for lasting well-being and for competence.
Well, Richard Weisbord, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Richard Weisbord is the author of the new book, The Parents We Mean to Be. He's a child and family psychologist who teaches at Harvard. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. Our program was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.